From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. The intimate face-to-face politics of Iowa and New Hampshire are over. And now the sensory bombardment really begins as candidates on both sides launch into their national campaigns. That means big money TV ads and stadium-sized rallies. Last night, the Republican candidate squared off in South Carolina. We'll talk to two political analysts about that debate in just a moment. But right now, we have Ron Elving. He is NPR's senior Washington editor, and he is here to give us an idea of what to expect from the candidates between now and Super Tuesday on February 5th. Hello, Ron.
Hello, Tony. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you, sir. Yesterday, Senator Bill Richardson announced he is dropping out of the Democratic race. Senators Chris Dodd and Joe Biden also dropped out of the contest after their poor showings in Iowa. This may or may not have been a surprise, Ron, but the question is, who stands to benefit most from Richardson's absence? And secondly, going into Nevada and South Carolina, which Democrat is next most at peril from a poor showing in either contest?
Let me start with the last question, Tony. I think the next Democrat you have to watch is John Edwards. He has not won yet. He has had a pretty good second in Iowa and was rather a distant third in New Hampshire. And his campaign really has to be considered on life support. He must win in South Carolina. If he doesn't, he really has no momentum to go on into Florida and then the huge, huge casino on February 5th. So money argues against him. Momentum argues against him. I think John Edwards really needs to win in South Carolina on January 26th. But to back up and look at Bill Richardson's departure, you know, a lot of people said a lot of nice things about Joe Biden and about Chris Dodd when they dropped out. And I think really Bill Richardson leaves a more, well, perhaps special gap in the field by leaving so early. Biden and Dodd brought a lot to the debate, but, you know, they were a couple more senators. We've got a lot of senators running for president this year. Bill Richardson was the only sitting governor, the only guy who right now is a governor who is running, and the only Hispanic, first Hispanic American to be taken seriously running for president of the United States to be at this level. And he did get 5% in New Hampshire, just 2% in Iowa, but it wasn't enough to keep the money flowing in. A lot of people thought he would hang on until at least Nevada on the 19th, because that's the first place where you get a substantial Latino vote in this entire election. And so perhaps that was the moment for him to hang on and see what he could do to influence that one state, but he just ran out of money.
On the GOP side, it would seem to be a little more difficult to define who is a quote-unquote leading candidate and who is not, given the split results in Iowa and New Hampshire. But who would you say is on the bubble heading into Michigan?
Heading into Michigan, I think the guy you want to watch is John McCain, as the person who, if he can win in another state, can really confirm this idea that he is a totally remade reality in Republican politics. After having been the number two in 2000, after having come back this year initially as front runner, then falling into the absolute depths over the summer when this campaign fell apart, then coming all the way back, largely because other guys who were supposed to be heavy hitters like Rudy Giuliani and Fred Thompson didn't really make it, didn't really materialize as front-running candidates, at least not yet. They haven't been a factor. And also because Mitt Romney, the guy who was supposed to win Iowa and New Hampshire, didn't win either one. So in Michigan, it's largely between McCain and Romney. Whichever one of them wins gets a real nice boost going into the later events of this month. And then, of course, Mike Huckabee's still in the picture when we get down to South Carolina. He's going to be a big factor.
How much of a problem would it be for Romney if he does not show well in Michigan?
Well, I think if he fails in Michigan, which is, after all, his native state and one more of his home states, if he fails there, you really have to ask, why are we still expecting this guy to win any place? These are the concentrated targets of his campaign, Iowa, New Hampshire, Michigan. If he doesn't win any of them, it's really going to look as though the sale is just not being closed, even by this master salesman. I think everyone has been impressed with what an extraordinary salesman he has been in the debates and in his campaigning, but he's not closing the sale and actually winning any events.
One final thing, Ron. Nevada's caucus is a week away. This will be the first time that we will see results from a heavily populated Latino voter bloc. They make up about 25% of Nevada's population. Is there any indication how Latinos are voting either Democratically or GOP?
Well, Bill Richardson's dropping out, of course, removes the main magnet for them. But I think they'll still turn out in good numbers. A quarter of the population, as you say, about 13% of the voters in the state by estimated strength, disproportionately on the Democratic side. I think probably Barack Obama is going to benefit from the endorsement by the Culinary Workers Union, which is about 40% Hispanic, and also the Service Workers Union, smaller but also very significant in that area. So I think he's in a good position to benefit from Bill Richardson's dropping out.
Ron, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
We've been speaking with NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. He spoke with us from our studios in Washington, D.C. Now we have a closer look at last night's debate. We turn to Fox News analyst Angela McGlowan and political pundit Michael Fauntroy. He is a professor of public policy at George Mason University. Angela, Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us. Tony, you didn't talk about my book, Bamboozled.
Oh, well, I'll try to get that before we finish.
Thank you.
First question, though, is this, and I'll bring it to you, Angela.
Yes.
An obvious one. Was there a clear winner or clear loser in last night's debate?
There was no clear loser. I think all the candidates, you know, shined as much as they could last night. Basically, we talked a lot about the war in Iraq and terrorism. And the person that's always done well, that's always stood out, is McCain. McCain is a shining star, and I do agree with Ron. He is the one to watch in Michigan and also Mitt Romney. And I'd like to add to what Ron said, Mitt Romney's father was governor of Michigan. And I worked for Senator Bob Dole in 95 and 96. And Mitt Romney, to me, he looks presidential, but he can't close a cell. And if you remember Bob Dole in 1996, he couldn't reach the masses. And I think that Mitt Romney has that Bob Dole syndrome. So if he doesn't pull it out in Michigan, I think he's going to have a big uphill climb and a challenge.
What's your assessment, Michael?
I think all of the candidates but for John McCain lost. And I say that because when McCain is on the verge of establishing himself as the clear front runner, I think he got a tremendous amount of boost from New Hampshire. And when you look at how the other candidates really didn't challenge him on very much, I think when you're the front runner or moving toward front runner status, and the other candidates effectively give you a pass, then I think that just sort of confirms your strength. And so, from my perspective, McCain was the clear winner, and the rest of them really didn't do anything to help themselves at all.
The one thing that I'd like to add is that to your analysis, no one can take that terrorism moniker away or that patriot moniker away from McCain, and no one really wants to bash him on his policy dealing with the war on terror because he has given so much to this country, fighting in Vietnam, being a POW, and I think that all of the candidates respect McCain. However, don't count Giuliani out because he's going to take Florida, and then Super Tuesday is just right around the corner.
All right, let me move on to another topic. On the Democratic side, the message so far in the campaign is all about change. And after last night, it seems the Republicans now have their own mantra, and it is Ronald Reagan. Here's one of the many references to the popular former president that we heard last night, this one coming from Mitt Romney.
The only way we're going to win the White House is by appealing to the coalition that brought together the great strength that Ronald Reagan brought to America. What's happened in America is that Washington has moved away from the Reagan coalition. The Republican Party, in some cases, has moved away from the Reagan principles. But the principles that Ronald Reagan espoused are what will allow us not only to win the White House, but to keep America strong.
So, Michael, why are the Republicans referencing Ronald Reagan so much right now? And is there a GOP candidate who you think whose campaign is actually resonating with Reaganites?
They are calling Reagan's name so often because he's the last popular Republican president. It would be fool's gold to do that with the current President Bush or the previous President Bush. And so, you know, Ronald Reagan's name evokes certain thoughts among Republican voters. And so I understand why they're doing it. The problem, though, Tony, is in many respects, that Republican coalition doesn't exist in the same way that it did a generation or so ago. And so while I understand that that may work in a Republican primaries nominating contest sort of circumstance, I'm not sure it's the sort of thing that can get you to the White House. And so I think that the candidates who evoke Reagan's name do so for understandable reasons, but those reasons won't get them to the White House.
Is there a candidate, Angela, who brings to mind Ronald Reagan?
Nobody brings me to mind to Ronald Reagan. But one thing I'd like to disagree with your analysis is from the standpoint our conservative foundation is strong. Now, in 2006, there was a stay home by conservatives because they were disgruntled with the party from dealing with Mark Foley and the spending, wasteful spending. But Ronald Reagan was the great communicator, and he's the great hero of the party. And yes, you are right. We do need to invoke Ronald Reagan to get our base out there to support a candidate. I do agree with you with this, though. In a national campaign, Ronald Reagan is not going to get someone in the White House. What will get someone in the White House is the person that's tough on terrorists, the person that's in the front on national security, and people care about the economy and the price of oil. So I think it's many things there. But right now, Ronald Reagan is very popular still amongst conservatives and in history.
Here's my final question. We have about a minute left. When do you think we will finally get a sense of who the front runner is going to be, the standard bearer is likely to be for the Republican Party, Michael?
Well, I think if there is one candidate who wins both Michigan and South Carolina, and let's say that candidate is McCain, then I think you begin to see the beginning of the end for the remaining candidates. Rudy Giuliani has not distinguished himself at all. Mitt Romney is fading badly. Mike Huckabee has problems. Fred Thompson has not done anything. And so I think if McCain gets Michigan and South Carolina, I think he then becomes the front runner and is very, very close to locking up the nomination.
It won't be until after Super Tuesday that we will see who the true front runner will be, because Huckabee still gets a lot of those votes of the conservative base. And in South Carolina, I think he's going to give McCain a run for his money. I think in Michigan, too, he's going to give Mitt Romney and McCain a run for their money. So I think it's going to take Super Tuesday for us to see.
I appreciate both of you coming on. Michael and Angela, thank you. We have been speaking with Fox News analyst Angela McGlowan. She is the author of the best-selling book, Bamboozled, How Americans Are Being Exploited by the Lies of the Liberal Agenda. Also joined by Michael Fauntroy, a political analyst and professor of public policy at George Mason University. He spoke with us from our NPR studios in Washington. This is News in No Time, Tony Cox. We've been talking politics today, hashing out the winners and losers of last night's GOP debate in South Carolina. Now we'd like to take a look at how all the campaigning may play out in the Palmetto State. Joining us for our Reporters Roundtable today are Michael Fletcher, national economics writer and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post, Theola LeBay, an education reporter also for The Post, and Corey Dade, who was an Atlanta correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us on the campaign trail in South Carolina. Welcome to all three of you.
Good to be here, Tony.
Hi there.
Hello.
Corey, let's start with you. Since you are in South Carolina, give us a quick peek into what the future holds on the ground there in the next several days.
Well, South Carolina has become the next battleground for several reasons. Blacks make up half the turnout in the Democratic primary, so this is the first test for the candidates in appealing to blacks and to really gauge where masses of black voters are. South Carolina also sets the tone for how the rest of the South may vote and provides the most significant momentum for the winner of this primary heading into the February 5th primaries. So on the ground here, Clinton and Obama have taken different approaches. The Clinton campaign has locked up early endorsements from black politicians and ministers, while the Obama campaign has built a pretty large field organization to push into black neighborhoods. And then you have, of course, John Edwards, who has established South Carolina as his firewall. He was born here, he still has family ties here, and he won the South Carolina primary in 2002. So at this point, most polls show Obama leading Clinton among blacks and among all Democratic voters overall, and notably, the polls show that he's tied with Clinton among women.
You know, we're hopefully we'll be able to get your line a little cleaned up. We could hear you, but there's some difficulty there. We apologize to the audience for that. We're going to work on it. You mentioned polling, and that's an interesting point. I'd like to come to Michael Fletcher to talk about that, because on the heels of the New Hampshire primary, Newsday put out an article slugged, "Where Did Pollsters Go Wrong in New Hampshire? What is the role of the political pundit, and what's the point of listening to them if they're wrong or at least not always right?" Now, I mentioned the compressed primary schedule earlier in a conversation that I had about its possible impact. And I'm wondering from your point of view, Michael, how the quick turnarounds are affecting the business of predicting the outcomes.
I think it's tougher because everything, as you said, gets compressed, and pollsters will tell you that often things swing late, but, you know, late becomes a shorter time window now. So a lot of the polling in New Hampshire was done, you know, by that Saturday, and, you know, by the time that ended, you know, things had shifted. So when you have a compressed window, it just makes it, I think, a lot harder to catch kind of the turns and the swings in the electorate. Not only that, they, as you know, they talk about having some problems with the samples, and there was a bigger turnout than anticipated. So all of those things can skew what you see in a poll.
Theola, isn't the schedule itself a bit confusing for voters? It is quite a change from what we're used to.
Let me tell you, I've got friends who are covering this election, and I don't know whether we can go out for a drink on a certain day or have dinner, because one day they're slated to be in South Carolina. They may turn around the next day and then head out to Ohio. And as someone who is following this, not just also personally, but also professionally, I do know that all politics is local. And what I'm seeing here in the nation's capital, but more for the area and residents here, is that they're still waiting to hear some of these substantive issues talk to know, okay, where is Obama, let's say, on education, for example? Or I think that maybe for Edwards, we do know where he stands on some of the issues like lobbyists and such. But, you know, those pocketbook taxes sorts of issues where folks can say, I want to vote for this person because I know how they will affect the economics of my personal household.
Well, you know, this will be the first time, Corey, I believe you're back with us, right?
Yes.
All right. This is the first time that we will get a chance to see a substantive block of black voters choose, on the Democratic side at least, between presumably Obama and Hillary Clinton. Do you have a sense of how that is going in South Carolina right now?
Well, at this point, South Carolina is the battleground for so many different reasons. Obviously, blacks make up half the turnout in the Democratic primary, but beyond that, This result will set the tone for how the rest of the South may vote, and it provides significant momentum for the winner heading into the February 5th primaries. As far as the black vote here, the Clinton and Obama camps have taken sort of different approaches. The Clinton campaign locked up early endorsements from prominent black politicians and ministers, while the Obama campaign, because they initially lacked the name recognition, built a large field organization aimed at reaching black voters directly in their communities. And at this point, Obama has now taken the lead from Clinton in the polls among African-American voters and Democratic voters overall in the state. And most significantly, perhaps, is that Obama now is tied with Clinton in the polls among women.
You know, it's one thing to think back to when Jesse Jackson first ran for the presidency and how that energized the black community, not only in terms of debate, but also in terms of voter turnout. Is there any sense that Obama's presence in South Carolina is going to affect the turnout, particularly among black voters, Corey?
I think so. There's every sign of that, in that he has gone after young black voters who have never voted before. But what's also significant is that his a huge portion of his get out the vote effort relies on volunteers who are unpaid, who are black, who are under 35, and have never participated in the process before. So that's one issue. The other issue is that the more this becomes contested by both candidates, the more attention South Carolina gets, the more they get the attention, particularly of rural blacks. So as long as this is a hot battleground, there is every indication that this could be, if not a record turnout among blacks in South Carolina, but a big one.
Let's move on to another topic. I'm going to come to you on this, Michael Fletcher. President Bush announced this week he thinks there will be a signed peace treaty between Israel and Palestine by the time that he leaves office. Talk, if you will, about the timing of such an announcement and the attention that it has generated in the press. Is it skepticism, optimism, what?
Well, I think among the press is a lot of skepticism, and because this is the same President Bush who for so long you know, wasn't really deeply involved in the Middle East peace process. I mean, they laid the roadmap, as they call it, in the early part of his administration. But since then, it has been largely a hands-off issue for President Bush. Then, of course, I mean, the Baker-Hamilton Commission, and it, you know, mentioned that the United States should take a more active role in trying to bring about some kind of, you know, broker some kind of long-term deal between the Palestinians and Israelis as a way to kind of, you know, take the energy out of the sort of anti-Americanism in the Middle East and among Islamics generally. And so you see, I think you see President Bush's action motivated by that, you know, most of all. But I don't know that it, you know, he can really deliver on what he says, because there are a lot of hurdles in the way and the things he's talking about, what to do with Jerusalem, things like that. I don't think these things will be settled, because these are old issues that have deep-seated feelings on both sides.
Viola, if he is successful, it would certainly be a boost not only for President Bush, but for the Republican Party as well. But if it falls apart, especially before the November elections, how might the presidential campaign be affected, if at all?
You know, Tony, it's very interesting. We have talked before about the time that I spent in Iraq. And as I watch this presidential campaign, I think that the Arab world is very closely watching this election, because Bush, to them, in some respects, has been a pretty significant president in terms of influencing policy there, obviously with the invasion into Iraq and some of his other comments about neighboring states and such. And so I'm not sure if something is signed or not, kind of how that might play out, because largely I've seen and heard the candidates talk very opaquely about Iraq and about the Arab world, because right now the message seems to be focused on change and which candidate can actually claim the mantle of change. And that is, and that to me is also on the GOP side as well as the Democrats.
Let me let our audience know what we are doing. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea today. If you are just tuning in, with me on today's roundtable are Michael Fletcher, Theola LaBey, both with the Washington Post, and Corey Dade with the Wall Street Journal. Corey, an outgoing president is in a tough spot, isn't he, when it comes to leading the nation and at the same time trying to help his party stay in the White House during a tough, close race. How effective is a president at being presidential and partisan now that we're in the middle of the primary, at the beginning of the primary season?
Well, I think President Bush has shown no problem in being partisan. I don't think that will change going forward. I think what's significant is that none of the Republican candidates for the nomination have been able to latch themselves to his record. They have tried to find ways to express support for continued occupation of Iraq and pressing the war, but at the same time have distanced themselves from the president. And I think that will continue. As far as Bush is concerned, he has given every indication that he's going to try to give the Republican Party some victories, because it's not just about the presidential holding on to the White House for the Republicans. It's also about gaining seats in the House if they can and holding on to their slight advantage in the Senate. So this has reverberations for all the congressional elections that are going on this year.
Well, Michael, you've covered the White House before. Is there a point at which you determine as a member of the press corps that you see the White House prerogatives beginning to move in diverging directions? Because as Corey was just talking about, on one hand, you have to remain presidential. On the other, you have to protect the party if you can. And thirdly, you have to try to protect the seats in Congress.
You know, it's been interesting with this White House, because I think a lot of Republicans in Congress actually are frustrated with President Bush. Before the midterm elections, for example, many Republicans were hoping he would make some kind of significant move in terms of changing strategy in Iraq. And he waited until after the elections to, you know, to fire Rumsfeld and things like that. So this president has been somewhat unique. While he's, you know, he's been kind of pushing his agenda, pushing for his foreign policy. And I think with the rationale being that if he's successful, that in the end will help Republicans. But along the way, he's really kind of broken with what a lot of congressional leaders would have liked to have seen. They say he doesn't listen to them. President Bush has done a lot of spending as president, and that's left a lot of Republicans vulnerable in Congress. So he's been kind of a president interested in furthering his presidency.
When the president was reelected to office in 2004, he declared that he had earned political capital. This is my last question about that. We're going to move on to another topic. And he intended to spend that capital. Theola, although he seems to be spending it now, how much capital does the current president currently have?
I think when you wake up to headlines about countrywide stock falling precipitously and then needing a buyout, I think that those sorts of things are tied directly to Bush, and that capital is dwindling, if not, you know, dead. I mean, someone once said famously, it's the economy, stupid. And I think that clearly that has emerged of the story of 2008. And everyone now is looking ahead because of this contest for president. And because, as Michael said, Bush has been so good about thinking about Bush and then his legacy, I think that folks are now saying, look, we went into Iraq. We had a president who said, I am the decider. And now, years later, I may not be able to refinance my mortgage. And so I want somebody new. I want change. I'm just really not sure who that might be.
Final thing is this. You might call this story the tale of the videotape. It's an update on a story that we have been watching this week, U.S. Navy releasing footage of a reported Iranian speedboat racing and circling three American warships going through the Strait of Hormuz. Reports of the encounter describe an Iranian in one of the small boats threatening the warship by saying over the two-way, I'm coming to you, you will explode after a few minutes. And then yesterday, the Iranian state television issued its own version, its own videotapes, showing something very different. We have two clips. Here's the first one. This one is of the Iranian TV.
Coalition warship 73, this is Iranian Navy patrol boat. A request side number Hilo operating in the area this time. Over.
Now, that was the Americans. Here comes the American version of another part of that encounter.
I am coming to you. You will explode from me.
Now, what do we make of this? We didn't hear the full encounter from either side. How do you approach something like this, Michael?
It's very tough. I note today that the Pentagon has backed off of its, I guess they said they didn't make the assertion, but they now say that there's no telling that this alleged threat came from the patrol boat, because apparently this is an open channel and that could have been a transmission from another boat, even not that close to the American warships. But nonetheless, the Americans are sticking to this idea that it was a provocative act by the Iranians, the way they were maneuvering the small boats. At one point, they claim one of the boats dropped a box into the water, and that was a threatening and a very dangerous move, according to the Americans. But it is interesting that they've backed off of perhaps the most explosive assertion.
We don't have a lot of time left, but Corey, how important is Iran in terms of the president's foreign policy portfolio, do you think?
Well, at this point, you know, the president is the lame duck. So the fact that they are trying to shift to Israeli relations with Palestine and those issues kind of demonstrates that Iran is going to be less important going forward, because you have a national intelligence estimate that revealed sort of the status of Iran's nuclear development program. And I think that gave the administration, clearance, as it were, to sort of back away from those, from the contentiousness of those relations. And I think at this point, there may continue to be sparring back and forth, but the White House knows that neither Congress nor the American public has the will give the support for escalating any type of conflict with Iran, with the nation still engaged in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I think you will see the U.S. over the next year, as you're certainly the president, sort of keep issues of Iran at bay as best they can. And I don't look at this latest controversy as being a significant escalation going forward.
That's taken the time that we have to talk about this subject today. I thank you all for coming with us, Theola, Mike, and Corey. Michael Fletcher is national economics writer and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Theola LeBay, an education reporter also for The Washington Post. Both she and Mike joined us from The Washington Post studios in our nation's capital. And Corey Dade with The Wall Street Journal. Thank you. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Today, professional football sports about half a dozen black starting quarterbacks. Donovan McNabb, Steve Young, Steve McNair are just a few who take the field on Sundays. The number in 1968? None. That's right, zero. In fact, African Americans were thought to be incapable of performing as quarterbacks, a position arguably considered the most important in professional sports. Enter Marlon Briscoe. 1968 was his rookie year, drafted to play defense for the Denver Broncos, but Briscoe had another idea. Today we continue our Great Expectations series by taking another look at the ways people have triumphed over the low expectations of others. We'll talk with Marlon Briscoe about how he became the first black starting quarterback of the modern football era. Marlon, welcome to News and Notes.
Thank you, Tony.
Listen, give us a little bit of background. You were an All-American in high school and college. You could do it all, but your specialty, your dream, as every young athlete is, I suppose, who plays football, was to be the quarterback.
Absolutely.
Tell me, how did that come about?
Well, you know, I loved football when I was a kid, and I would watch the professional games on TV during the weekend, and I saw no black quarterbacks, and I was enamored with Johnny Unitas and always wanted to be like Johnny Unitas. So I would go out in the projects and throw at this little tree and pretend it was Raymond Berry and Lenny Moore. And ended up working out for me, and my dream came true.
Now, you went into the NFL as a defensive player. You were drafted as a defensive player, correct?
That's correct. Cornerback.
Cornerback, right. Now, you got to be a quarterback, which is on the offense for people that are not familiar. You got to be a quarterback in a game. How did that come about? What did you have to do? And tell us briefly the circumstances that allowed you to become a signal caller for the first time.
Well, after having success in college and getting drafted in the 14th round by Denver as a cornerback, I still felt that I deserve at least a look at quarterback. So when I signed before I signed my contract, I stipulated that I would have an opportunity to have a 3-day trial at quarterback, since Denver was one of the only teams in the NFL that held their practices before the media and the fans. Denver certainly didn't want to give me that opportunity, but finally they acquiesced to my so-called demands and gave me that 3-day trial, which I fared very well. After the 3 days, I went back to defensive back. And in the meantime, the starting quarterback, Steve Tenzi, got hurt, and the other two quarterbacks that were in that camp, they proved inept. So the media and the fans remembered that 3-day trial, and they began clamoring, "Hey, why don't you give the little guy a chance?" So that's how it happened.
Did you finish the season that season at quarterback?
Yes, I did. I was a starting quarterback for the last 7 games of the year, played in 11, and hopefully I made an impact. I think that let the nation know and the naysayers know that a black man could think, throw, and lead on that level.
It wasn't exactly Jackie Robinson, and yet I imagine there were pressures that you felt from your teammates, from the media, from the crowd about how you should perform.
Well, you know, I was in the national stage, on the national spotlight, because if I had failed, it would have taken that much longer for black quarterbacks to be accepted as field generals on the field in the NFL. I felt that if I have a legacy at that position, which I never got a chance to play again, is that the naysayers of the world were refuted by my performance, I hope.
You know, a lot of what our series is about is how people overcome and how they triumph. As you look back now on that experience, what would you say it was that pushed you over the top, that gave you the courage, the strength, whatever you needed to succeed against the odds?
Well, first of all and foremost, confidence and a never give up attitude. You know, that has served me well in life, and certainly the lessons I learned growing up in Omaha, Nebraska, getting an opportunity in college to play the position, to gain the confidence that I had in myself, certainly played a large part.
What was your record that first season?
I threw 14 touchdown passes in 11 games, a record, a rookie record that still stands today 40 years later.
How many games did you win?
I think we won 5 out of the 7 games that I started. And that was the proudest moment, because not only did it set records, we were able to win. And the teammates rallied around me. You have to understand, a lot of my teammates, particularly my offensive line, were white kids from the South who had never played with blacks in college. And for them to rally around me as a leader, you know, that was significant.
And yet, at the end of that season, Marlon Briscoe, you went to another team and never played quarterback again. Is that right?
That is correct. I made the transition from quarterback to wide receiver at Buffalo, and that was a position I had never played in my life. So it was quite a feat.
Why did you do that? If you always wanted to be a quarterback, you had gone to such extremes to make sure you had the opportunity to play for Denver. You did play. You were successful by your own account. And yet, a season later, you're out of that position.
Yeah, it was kind of traumatic for me, because I went back home during that off season and to finish up my degree, and heard through the grapevine that they were having quarterback meetings without me. And here I was, starting quarterback at the end of the year, and I don't get invited to these quarterback meetings. Well, I took a flight to Denver and sat outside Saban's office as the quarterbacks came out of that meeting, and he couldn't even look me in the eye. It was obvious at that point that they weren't going to give me an opportunity. Now, I never demanded to be a starter in 1969. All I wanted was an opportunity to compete based upon what I was able to accomplish in 1968, but that wasn't going to be. I asked for my release thinking that I was going to get an opportunity from other teams that I had played with, but that never happened, and I realized if I was going to stay in the National Football League, that I would have to make a transition to another position.
Here's my final thing for you, Marlon Briscoe. I've got about 30 seconds. Looking back over that experience, and now you are identified as the first African-American quarterback of the modern era in the football, in the history of football. Is that important to you?
Yes, it is. You know, there can only be one first, as you know. And the fact that, you know, that position was held in such high esteem is, and I know this might seem far-fetched, but it's just like Obama getting elected as president. You can make that parallel. Blacks being head of Fortune 500 companies, it was significant because we gained respect for the fact that we could lead on that high level.
Marlon, thank you so much. Marlon the Magician Briscoe. He was the first black starting quarterback of the modern football era. Today he works with the Boys and Girls Club of America and is a founding member of the Field Generals. The group is made up of African-American former quarterbacks. Their mission, to develop a new generation of African-American quarterbacks. From an anchor on the football field, we now turn to a pioneering anchor in the broadcast booth. In 1988, Carol Simpson became the first woman of color to regularly host a national network news broadcast. But home viewers who saw her on ABC's World News Tonight had no way of knowing just how far she'd come. Carol joins us now to share the story of that journey. Carol, nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you, Tony.
You know, people don't often know how difficult it is to get into broadcasting, particularly in television, particularly in front of the camera, particularly at the network level. And you did all of those things. How difficult was it for you?
Oh, my God. How much time do we have? Do we have 80 hours to talk about it? I'm in the process of writing a book about it now, because as I go back over my life and the difficulties that were placed in my path, it just amazes me that I was able to overcome a lot of those obstacles.
Does something stand out in your mind that you really remember?
Well, yes. I remember everyone telling me, no, I couldn't do it. My parents said I couldn't do it. Northwestern University, where I wanted to go to journalism school, said that I could never get a job. I ended up going to the University of Michigan and having not found a job while all of my white classmates had found jobs. And the story I got from everywhere was that I was had three strikes against me. I was a woman, I was a Negro, and I was inexperienced. And it was true, I was all three of those things, and there was nothing I could do about it until somebody gave me some experience. So it was very tough finally getting a job. And then when I got a job, the first job I got was at WCFL Radio in Chicago, which was a very big 100,000-watt station. And it was the 60s, mid-60s after Watts, and the biggest story in America was the civil rights struggle. And reporters, white reporters, were not being able to cover the story. A lot of black people would not talk to them about what was happening. So you had news editors and news directors going literally off the street, pulling people off the street, saying, can you be a reporter mm-hmm. so you can help us cover this this huge story? So I give great thanks to those people that were part of the civil rights movement who said, you cannot send to your press conferences any white reporters anymore, any white cameramen, any white sound people. And that opened up the trade unions in Chicago, and it opened up a lot of the opportunities for us. But as I said, they were taking people off the streets, and a lot of them could not do the job, did not have the experience. And I was fortunate enough to be in the right place at the right time with the right qualifications to be able to succeed at being a reporter.
Tell people how you were intimidated or how people attempted to intimidate you, both in your radio days and then as you got into television.
Absolutely. Radio, as I told you, was a big station, and I was the first female to broadcast news in Chicago. So it was unusual. It was a big deal because people weren't used to hearing women deliver news. There were some lady shows in the afternoon on some of the radio programs, some of the radio stations, but nobody was doing any hard news. But I had a newscast. I was hired because I had the qualifications and the degrees in journalism, and I was given a newscast, and it was at 9 o'clock in the morning. And after I did my five-minute newscast, I would go out on the street and cover other news stories in the city of Chicago. During that 9 o'clock newscast, you're in a studio by yourself, and you're reading the news, and I would have my white male colleagues play little tricks on me. They thought they were little tricks. They would open the door to the control room where I was working and would take their pants down and show me their big white butts while I was on the air. Or they would, one time, they threw a big black rubber tarantula on the desk while I was trying to do the news. They would get behind me, come into the studio and stand behind me and take papers out of my hand and set fire to them. And, you know, everything they could do to make me mess up on the air. But what they ended up doing was actually making me stronger. I was able to, you know, completely ignore that, think only about that microphone and my job to do the news. And it made me much stronger.
Let me interrupt you to ask you this, because our time is running short, and I want people to know, and let me just say as an aside, that happened to me as well, in terms of being mooned while you're on the air live. I know what that feeling is.
No, you don't, when it's a male's butt.
Well, a butt is a butt, okay? A white butt is a white butt looking at you when you're trying to talk to people on the air. But that aside, Marlon Brisco told us just a moment ago about how important it was for him to overcome, and that there was a certain intestinal fortitude that he had to rely on to be successful. What did you rely on, Carol Simpson, personally, to see you through the travails that you had to encounter?
The same things he did, except I guess mine was an anger. I'm sorry to say, but it was an anger that motivated me because so many people said I couldn't do it. And I tell young people today that I used those no's as vitamin pills to give me energy to go on and fight the battle. But it was the determination to show them that I could do it, that you can't tell me after I have, you know, gone to school, gotten this experience, prepared myself, that I am not capable and that I should be denied this job based on my color and my skin. I had, unlike Mr. Briscoe, the double whammy of people who didn't like me because I was female and people who didn't like me because I was black. So I think it's tougher for black women than it is for black men. And I look, you look around, there are no black women who have replaced me on any of the major networks. That hurts me. I've been off the air for almost 5 years now, and there is still no one who is replacing me. You see lots of Hispanic women, but I'm very concerned about what's happening to African American
women on the air.
Women and men on the air.
Well, you certainly have contributed to it. Our time is up, unfortunately, and we can't go on any further. But
what a shame!
Your contribution is without question, and we thank you for coming on our program today.
Thank you so much, Tony.
Journalist and educator Carol Simpson. She spoke with us from Martha's Vineyard, where she is currently writing.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music.
Upon a broken guitar.